Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. Just as a note for everybody, Shad is away this week, taking some time off, getting out in the countryside, so I am running the show all this week, which will still be a very busy week. I am chatting right now with John Rubino, founder and editor of the Dollar Collapse website. Now, John, you sent over a few topics. A lot of the topics here focused on, again, what the next, I guess, breaking point might be for these markets, or if a more substantial shock event comes into the markets to cause an even further downdraft. One aspect, though, that I think we should touch on here is central bank policy. We've talked a lot about it, and broadly, I've been saying that, look, central banks are reading off the playbook that is a tightening playbook here. They're all starting to tighten policy, some more aggressively than others. But we can look to the Bank of Japan that isn't reading off this playbook. Bank of Japan is continuing to keep monetary policy easy, and the excuse they are using is that they don't want the economy to slow down, which is a very different excuse than what we're hearing out of all the other central banks that are trying to fight inflation. John, break down your thoughts on Japan's policy here and how different it is going against all the other central banks that we cover on a regular basis.
Well, Corey, Japan is just in a really bad spot because they actually started this whole modern monetary theory thing much earlier than a lot of other countries. They had their gigantic bubble in the 1990s, and ever since, they have been borrowing huge amounts of money at the central government level and then just financing it by creating as many new yen as it takes. And they've pushed interest rates down to negative levels and kept them there for a really long time. The central bank's policy is to peg the interest rate on government bonds and then just offer to buy as many bonds as it takes to hold the yield at that level. They're doing that with the 10-year bond, and for a stretch of a couple of weeks, they were unable to consistently keep the bond at the chosen yield level of 0.25%. In other words, the market was kind of running over the central bank. And if that happens, that's a huge deal because that's the next stage of the collapse of the concept of modern monetary theory in the opinion of its detractors. In other words, you end up creating so much money and inflation starts to pick up, and then the central bank can't peg bond yields at a low level anymore. And bond yields spike, which causes the interest costs of the government to spiral out of control, and then the currency collapses. You know, that's the scenario that most skeptics when it comes to modern monetary theory think is going to play out. And Japan is kind of ahead of the curve, where they're at one stage further than most of the other countries of the world are. So what happens to Japan happens to the rest of us in due time. So this is, it's very important to watch this. Now, right now, today, the yield on the 10-year in Japan is 0.23%, which is below their target level, which means they might have gotten it back under control. But we'll see. This is just a really important thing to watch because it has implications for everybody else.
Now, the Bank of Japan really is the only buyer, or at least the buyer of last resort for a lot of these government bonds, helping to keep the, I guess, general interest rates lower there. But John, is there a breaking point where that central bank simply runs out of money? Or is this just another sign that central banks, they can keep on printing and, I guess, still control the market? Japan showing us that you don't need to be tight right now, and they're keeping their interest rates generally restrained.
Well, a central bank can't run out of money because it has an unlimited printing press. It can always print new currency. So the key is the value of that currency. And if it falls in the market, in other words, the people who can decide whether they want to or don't want to own that currency, and the value of the currency starts to fall because they don't want to own it, that's the end of the game. And what's happening with the yen right now is it's plunging versus the dollar, at least. It's what, like 135 or something like that? Let me check that while we're talking to make sure I have the right number, but it's something like that. 135. So it's 135 yen to the dollar. And fairly recently, 100 was more normal. So the value of the yen is starting to fall. And if it continues to fall, that removes the ability of the central bank to peg interest rates, because the cost is plunging currency and spiking inflation. So that's the box that Japan is in right now. It can buy all the 10-year government bonds that are issued by the government. But to do that, they have to create a huge number of new yen. And if that pushes the price of the yen down, or on foreign exchange markets, the value of the yen, then it's game over. So we're kind of looking at the early stage of that scenario playing out. Now, there's no guarantee that it does play out, but when it happens, it'll look a lot like what's happening right now.
Yeah, that's the thing. Their currency is dropping quite substantially. They've addressed that in some of their meetings, saying that they're watching their currency, but quite frankly, again, more focused on the economy. All related back to the markets, though, John, it really feels like we're just waiting for another catalyst or an initial bigger catalyst that could cause a larger market fall, a much quicker one, rather than this more or less grinding 6 months that we've had, where instead of buy the dip, it's been sell any rip, which is a very different market. That's what we're seeing around the world, though. So in your eyes, again, are we just waiting for some sort of a catalyst to push these markets down much quicker?
Well, there are a lot of possible catalysts out there. There's no way to know which one comes first or which one comes at all. But if inflation stays high, that would do it. I mean, if we stay at 8, 9, 10% inflation, then the central banks of the world are going to be forced to raise interest rates even more aggressively than, for instance, the Fed is doing with their last 0.75% increase. And at some point, that breaks the leveraged speculating community. In other words, there's a huge amount of money that's being bet out there on financial stability. In other words, a return to normalcy, buy the dip, that kind of attitude. And if it doesn't work, then people will learn the opposite lesson, which is, like you said, sell everything. And then the financial markets collapse. And we're kind of back in the 1930s if that happens. You know, that's Great Depression level stuff if it happens. And there's geopolitics as it affects energy. If oil goes to $150 a barrel U.S., then that's a really disruptive thing. And geopolitics, if the Russian-Ukraine thing gets worse from here instead of better. So there's a lot of things going on that could all blow up the financial market. And none of them are guaranteed, but they all are completely conceivable in this world. So, we'll have to see how it goes. But the idea of a return to normalcy, normal being financial asset prices going up, inflation being really well behaved, and geopolitics being nice and placid, that's probably the lowest probability outcome of all the things I just mentioned. So, lots of stuff can happen. We can't know what, but most of the things that could easily happen from here are pretty bad.
Now, a lot of people are watching energy, and energy went through a bit of a correction at the tail end of last week. Oil up around 120, now around 110. A lot of people were saying higher energy prices, that's going to be or continue to be a drain on the consumer. What about on the flip side? If oil prices drop here, they've really been the only sector that's been outperforming. To me, that could cause a pretty severe market decline too if that sector drops out of bed.
Yeah, that might be seen as a deflationary signal, which would scare people out of things that do best during, an inflationary boom that we've kind of seen so far. So, yeah, that could be a disruptive force. I see when you get to this point, when you've borrowed as much money as we have borrowed, there's a dark side to almost any event in the economy or in the markets, just because there's so much leverage out there that somebody is hurt. Somebody big is hurt by almost anything going up or down, and that's where we are now. Derivatives are what? There's close to $250 billion notional value of derivatives on the bank's books now. And there's a huge amount of leverage in real estate, and there's still a lot of margin debt in the stock market. So anything is dangerous. And oil falling from here, or energy in general falling from here, could be a sign that the economy is tipping over into a recession, which has huge risks of its own. So, yeah, I think energy either way. If you look at the oil price, you can read dangerous signs in a move in either direction. And a move in either direction is still pretty possible. You know, we could see a spike in oil just because, well, geopolitics is so unsettled right now. We're nowhere near the end of the Russian Ukrainian war necessarily. I mean, it could be settled tomorrow with an announcement from Putin and the guy running Ukraine that they've decided to come to an armistice and it's all over. But on the other hand, it could get worse from here. You know, Russia could start blowing up convoys of weapons coming in from the West and killing German soldiers or something like that, and it spins out of control and roils the energy markets really dramatically. So yeah, there's no way to know which of these things plays out. That's the thing. You can't know even whether we're going to be in inflation or deflation as a general dominant trend 6 months from now. Either one is completely possible.
That is true. I like your comment, though. Oil up or oil bad, both are bad in your eyes. So that doesn't seem too optimistic in either direction. Let's also talk about cryptos, because cryptos continue to be under pressure. Bitcoin over the weekend dropped below that $20,000 level, but then pretty quickly recovered, dropped to almost like $3,000, I believe. And then again, recovered and is just above that $20,000 level right now. Cryptos continue to be under pressure. Everything's been under pressure, but again, cryptos are showing it is more of a risk-on trade, more of a speculative play. What's your view on cryptos here? And again, could that be another shock to the system?
Well, cryptos had an epic bull market. You know, they went from what, 15,000 at the last low, or 20,000 or something like that, up to 69,000 for Bitcoin. And that brought a lot of new people into the market. This was really Bitcoin in particular, and cryptos in general's coming out party, where a huge number of new people decided that this was the big new thing and got into it. And kind of a banking infrastructure emerged where you could lend your Bitcoin to somebody and they would offer you a massive return, like 17% interest on that Bitcoin. And they use terms that are not banking terms. So people didn't understand that it's just basically banking when you're lending your version of a currency to a bank that then does something with it to generate a high return and pays you part of that return in interest. You know, that's banking. But the returns that they were promising were so outlandish by current global interest rate standards that it should have been seen as a red flag, but it wasn't. A lot of people put a lot of money into these things expecting, you know, 15% or 17% return. And those quasi banks are blowing up now. And a lot of them are just locking people down where you can't get your money out anymore. In other words, there's a bank run. They've shut the doors, only it's all happening online. And a lot of very big players are on the hook for a lot of leverage right now. So we don't know who's going to blow up next, but several of these guys are in the process of imploding. And the way it works in banking is that when a few big financial entities start to implode, they can take down the rest of the system because it's a daisy chain of interlocking obligations. We just don't know what it's like in cryptos right now, who's on the hook for what. But it's a safe bet that given the amount of optimism that we've seen for the last couple of years and a lot of the risk-taking that went on, that it's not over yet. That at $20,000 per Bitcoin, there's still a lot of carnage to come. So if cryptos don't turn around and spike right back up, the next few months, the headlines will be kind of, oh, this thing blew up and this thing blew up. And so it'll have to work itself out via the market rather than via central banks coming in to bail them out. Because that's the other thing, you know, with banks, there's a chance that the government will come in and do loan guarantees and stuff like that and save JP Morgan Chase. But nobody's going to save Binance or something like that. These crypto companies are on their own, and the free market can be very brutally cruel to big financial entities that get over leveraged and don't have a government backstop.
Why haven't we seen more blowups then, John? Because this has been a pretty epic fall in the crypto space. And yeah, you're not the only one saying, look, people were leveraged up in here. They kept thinking it was going to go higher, but you would think we would have had maybe a couple more bigger, larger institution collapses at this point. What's keeping them afloat?
Well, we've seen some big scary ones so far, but what has to happen is it has to work its way through. Everybody doesn't go bankrupt at once. What happens is one gets into trouble, they try to work it out over a few weeks, and then they fail to work it out, and then they have defaulted rather than just temporarily frozen assets. And then the next domino falls. For instance, Michael Saylor is a good example of this. He's a guy who has an amazing story. He runs a tech company, and he came to the conclusion that Bitcoin was going to be the biggest thing ever, and directed his company's money into Bitcoin at lower prices, made an absolute fortune, you know, made billions of dollars by using his company's money to basically create a Bitcoin hedge fund. And the last thing he did was take out, in effect, a margin loan to buy more Bitcoin. And that was at much higher prices. So now Bitcoin is down. He has a big embedded loss. He's looking at margin calls if the price drops much from here. And it's not clear what that does to his company and whether it forces him to sell the Bitcoins that are now on his books and what that does to the Bitcoin price. See, so you get these secondary and tertiary effects. And that's just one big player in the space. There are lots of other whales out there in the crypto space that might be in kind of the same fix. So we'll just have to see. You know, it'll play out over months instead of weeks, more than likely. And a lot of it depends on how cryptos behave from here. If they go back up, that takes some of the pressure off. If they go down, that's going to lead to a lot of carnage.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where everyone's talking about cryptos as a place where a lot of people have lost a lot of money and are getting a wake-up call. But I think that's also happening in the U.S. equity markets because of how, in a way, orderly this bear market has started and how it continued to drift lower as the Fed, other central banks, seem like they will continue to tighten monetary policy. Again, we're all just kind of waiting for maybe that shock to the system that could bring everything lower, but then could also signify a bit more of a solid bottom. We're not there yet, but we'll see how the markets open up for this shortened trading week in the U.S. tomorrow. John, thanks for taking time on this holiday in the U.S. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Corey. You too.